We covered the process of the eventual amount that reaches the Philippines, which is $81 million. But they went after, as I said earlier, $951 million. Now, laundering $81 million bucks through the casino took them about a month to sit down and gamble. You've actually got to gamble $81 million bucks. It's a lot of money to gamble.
Hello, and welcome to Fishy Business, a series dedicated to exploring the lesser-known side of cybersecurity. I'm not Alice. She's off today. I'm Laura. I'm the producer of this podcast.
And I'm Brian, and we're colleagues at Mimecast. Every episode, we'll be joined by a special visitor who's definitely not your average guest to share tales of risk, reward, and sometimes ridiculousness.
We'll be looking for new ways to think about cybersecurity to learn how we can all improve in the fight to stay safe. Now, Brian, before we start today's episode, I have a few questions for you. Are you ready?
Yes, I am.
All right. Do you like crime thrillers?
I definitely do, yes.
All right, good. Do you like incredible true stories?
Absolutely, yes.
Do you like biographies?
Yeah, enjoy those too.
Fab and few. Then you will love our guest's new book. It's called The Lazarus Heist, and it's available out on June 9th.
I think I definitely will. If the podcast series is anything to go by, and I'm very envious that you actually got a sneak peek. I, unfortunately, wasn't that fortunate. Our guest today is Jeff White, investigative journalist, podcast host, and author. Welcome back to Fishy Business, Jeff, and thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
Now, Jeff, before we get started, I believe congratulations are in order. What does it feel like to be a Peabody nominated podcaster?
Oh, it feels really good. It feels really good. However, I will be completely honest about this. I like winning awards. I hate being nominated and not winning. I'll just be completely honest about that. That might seem really ungrateful. I'd rather they just say, oh, this person won.
Well, I'm definitely backing you to win that award. I absolutely love the podcast. And I'm fairly sure that if the book is anything like the podcast, it's going to be amazing. So without any spoilers, could you broadly just tell our listeners what The Lazarus Heist is actually about for those that haven't listened to the podcast yet or obviously had a chance to get hold of the book?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, it's basically the story of how North Korea became a computer hacking superpower. If you ask people in the UK intelligence community and you say, look, rank your top four threats, they'll usually say, well, China, Russia are number one and two interchangeably, and three and four would generally be Iran and North Korea. And for North Korea to be a sort of top four cyber threat to the UK is bizarre, given the fact that most people, the vast majority of people in North Korea, will never get access to the internet, let alone a computer. So the big question that we've been trying to answer is, well, how did this country become so adept at the cyber attacks that it's accused of carrying out? And what's the sort of story behind that? And where does it go next? I suppose that's the rough gist.
So we'll get into sort of all the alleged North Korean crime definitely further on. But what's the main aim of this book? What are you wanting readers to get out of it?
What I really want to explore in the book, which covers some of what the podcast does, but goes quite a lot further and covers quite a few of the newer, fresher stories about North Korea, because the podcast, the Lazarus Heist podcast, which we put out last year with my co-host Gene Lee, stopped in 2017. So obviously there's 5 years more of accusations against North Korea around the hacks that it's done, the targeting of cryptocurrency exchanges, all of that kind of thing. So I wanted to, cover all of those new stories. But secondly, I mean, there were just amazing, just incredible storylines about how North Korea has been pulled into these bizarre collaborations with people around the world. And what's interesting about that is you start to realize that in the North Korean example, you've got nation state hackers increasingly working with organized cybercrime and just organized street level crime, fraudsters and money launderers and so on, to make this whole operation swing. And what's interesting about that is I think that's the direction of travel for a lot of cyber activity and cyber crime activity.
And I think that's actually really fascinating. And in the podcast, you covered a lot of very high profile hacks. The main focus was the heist on the bank of, Bangladesh's National Bank. Mm. And then I'd love to actually hear about some of the more up-to-date stuff, but maybe let's just start there, or sort of the early, some of the earlier hacks. How did you first come to hear of the activities of this group?
Bangladesh Bank, I was sort of vaguely aware of. I was aware there'd been a hack on it, but didn't know a huge amount about initially. And then the WannaCry attack, obviously you couldn't avoid the WannaCry attack. It closed down hospital departments, for goodness sake. what was interesting was in the years following that, we suddenly start to get more and more detail come out. And the Bangladesh Bank case suddenly started to become more and more interesting the more information came out about it. For a start, Bangladesh Bank sued everybody. I mean, their criminal case was, I think, 40 different entities they were trying to sue for this. Ultimately, not yet successfully, I don't think. But so in the Bangladesh Bank lawsuit, there was a huge amount of detail from the bank itself, which for an investigative journalist is it's gold dust. You know, this is the bank actually saying what happened to it. But also the US government put out a criminal complaint in September 2018. And again, for investigative journalists, putting those pieces together, that's really, really helpful. So I think the way the Bangladesh Bank case came together was those two documents coming out, putting those together and realizing, wow, you've got all sides of the story here. And of course, you know, as I said, they didn't stop there. That was just one of their targets.
If we go back to sort of the alleged, you know, hacking group from North Korea, this particular one, what really struck me was in the book, you explain how they get sent across the border to China to sort of live and have, you know, potentially safer or less detectable access to the internet to sort of perpetrate their hacks from there. And my initial reaction was, why would they do that? Because they then have access to the internet, which is quite problematic for a quite authoritarian regime like North Korea. And wouldn't it just make them want to defect? But I think you made some interesting points around why they would send some of their hackers across the border. And I was wondering if you could elaborate on some of those.
Yeah. I mean, with my co-host Jean Lee from the podcast, did quite a lot of work on this. And she's obviously particularly clued up because she ran the AP Bureau in Pyongyang for several years. So she spent a lot of time in North Korea. And there are a couple of reasons why North Korea might want to send its hackers abroad to hack. As you said, there were some technical reasons. It's a lot easier to hide amongst China's many, many IP addresses than it is to hide among North Korea's very small number of IP addresses. But there's also some sort of cultural reasons why you might want to do it. I mean, as well, your listeners will know, you know, the social engineering side of these attacks is equally as important, if not perhaps more important, than the technical side. And to do social engineering, you have to understand how people think. You have to understand people's psychology.
I think you raise an interesting point that a fair number of these hacks that you've investigated actually seem to start from something really seemingly innocuous as a phishing email, business email compromise. In fact, I think you used the phrase depressingly familiar in one of the podcasts. So is there a misperception of the public that hackers always gain entry by some kind of cyber dark arts, but the reality is actually more often than not, they're kind of doing it the easy way?
Yes. Look, it's just unassailably true. If you're going after people's email addresses, you've just got more targets to go after. I mean, if you're trying to go after an organization's infrastructure, you know, its servers, its website, etc. You know, you've got one target to attack. You've got one sort of building to go after, but it's one entity. If you're going after people, if a company has 1,000 employees, well, you've got 1,000 chances, 1,000 different people with 1,000 different interests and 1,000 different things they might respond to, and one of them is going to be bored and not paying attention and open the email. So just it increases your attack surface. It increases the number of different types of lures you can use. And it is still the key way in. So it's right that phishing messages are still the way forward. I'd sort of row back from the fact phishing emails the way it's growing. I think phishing messages on lots of different platforms is what we now need to probably warn people about.
And I think what's interesting is, so obviously, you know, a lot of these hacks started with human error, somebody clicking on something that they shouldn't, and then thereby giving hackers a way in. But what I liked, maybe to redeem all of us, in the Bangladesh bank heist, it was sort of stopped a little bit by a human who noticed that the US Fed that money should probably be going out, and where were all these requests coming from? So is that a redeeming quality, that sometimes humans will query something and say, should we be sending all this money? Is this weird? Is this wise?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, it's a really good point, actually, though. I hadn't really thought of this, but it's a great example, actually, in a way, that the Bangladesh bank heist of the good collaboration of automated and human oversight. So the original target they went after was $951 million, which was how much Bangladesh Bank had sitting in its New York Fed account. Firstly, they failed with some of the transfers because the bank account they wanted to transfer the money to in Manila, in the Philippines, was in a bank branch in a place called Jupiter Street. There's loads of streets, obviously, gazillions of streets in Manila they could have used, but they just used the one in Jupiter Street for reasons that if you buy the book and have a read of it, you'll will become clear. But the word Jupiter popped up on the New York Federal Reserve Bank's automated checking system because Jupiter is the name of a sanctioned Iranian ship. And so anything with Jupiter in it just gets flagged, whether it's a ship or not. The word Jupiter just rings an alarm bell. So an automated system picked it up, which is good. A human being then looked at it, went, hang on, Bangladesh seems to be trying to empty out its entire account. Maybe we should query that. So they were sending messages back to Bangladesh, which, again, for reasons explained in the book, didn't reach Bangladesh, but a human did intervene. So it's a really good example, I think, of how automated systems can work, but also you need human oversight. And the two things working together, frankly, for me, that's defense in depth. You know, talk about defense in depth, I think that's a really good example of it.
And it strikes me as you're talking now, you're mentioning country after country as these sort of cross-border financial transfers take place. We often refer to cybercrime as a somewhat borderless crime, but in a sense, that's actually almost a misnomer, isn't it? I mean, the borders are actually quite critical to the cyber criminals. What was quite fascinating in the podcast was how for the alleged hack of the Bank of Bangladesh, they actually tied up several bank holidays and public holidays across different countries to kind of ensure that combination of understanding that there's not going to be people at work, that people are going to be, you know, not quite as on, you know, on guard as they would normally be, all of those kinds of things. But then also more importantly, just making it incredibly difficult to trace the sort of full sequence of criminal acts across multiple different legal jurisdictions.
Yes, yeah, it's a really good point, Brian, actually. Yeah, you're right. It is in a way, borderless. However, cybercriminals, I think, are intensely aware of borders, but how they can play them to their advantage. So you're right, in the case of Bangladesh Bank, the money was belonged to Bangladesh Bank, obviously, in Dhaka capital, but the money was sitting in New York. And so when they transferred the money out from New York, it was the middle of the night in Bangladesh. They also did it on a Thursday night. In Bangladesh, the weekend is Friday and Saturday. So when the New York Fed queried the transactions, as I said, they did, they were flagged because they contained the word Jupiter. Those queries didn't reach Bangladesh because it was the weekend. And there's various other reasons that they didn't get through, but that's part of it. And then they transferred the money, as I've said, to Manila. And as you rightly point out, there was a bank holiday Monday after that weekend in Manila. So none of the bank's timelines, none of the bank's schedules lined up with each other. When any one bank was in, the other banks were out and vice versa.
I also thought that virtual to physical line was really interesting because we talk a lot about the sort of the entry point. But as you point out, if you've stolen a huge amount of money, tens of millions of dollars, how do you launder it? And I think it sort of links back to the meat space, as hackers call it, the human, because humans do get suspicious of people going into casinos behaving a bit oddly when they've got an unbelievable amount of money. And they seem to sort of be gambling, maybe potentially not like regular rich people gamble. Could you tell us a little bit more about that? And also just what surprised you most about your research about that physical to virtual line of investigation?
Yeah, it was really interesting. So yeah, the money is virtual because it's sitting in a sort of bank account in the New York Fed. And that's the New York Fed doesn't have $951 billion all stacked up in a vault somewhere. It's digital. The money all gets transferred to accounts in the Philippines. But at a certain stage, that's all still traceable because whenever anything's digital, you can always trace the digital links. You can work out which bank account transferred to which bank account and so on. So to break the chain of traceability, the hackers at some stage had it converted by their accomplices into cash. Now you're talking about half a ton of cash. It's like a sort of grand piano's worth of cash that you then have to load onto a van, take to the casino, because the casinos was the next stop. You put it into the casinos, you change it for chips. So immediately you're changing the asset class, you know, virtual money into physical money into chips. They then get gambled across the casino tables, converted back into probably a casino check. So again, you change the asset class back from a chip into a casino check, you cash the check out, you leave the casino. So it's all these sort of different linkages that went on. I think for me around that, the biggest revelation was something I realized as we were investigating it. We covered the process of the eventual amount that reaches the Philippines, which is $81 million. But they went after, as I said earlier, $951 million. Now, laundering $81 million through the casino, it took them about a month to sit down and gamble. You've actually got to gamble $81 million. It's a lot of money to gamble. You can't just put all $81 million, you know, on red and hope, because you might lose the whole lot. You know, you've got to very gradually gamble this stuff away so that you make it back in a particular way. There's a way you can gamble the money and be pretty much assured you'll make a certain percentage back. But you can only do that if you gamble it very slowly and eke it out. They were going to do that with $951 million. It would have taken a year, wouldn't it? The idea they genuinely thought they could get $951 million through casinos in the Philippines by gambling it chip by chip across a casino table. That's just astonishing.
I guess the other problem with this whole thing is most people, it feels very kind of distant from their day-to-day lives, you know. So yes, sure, you know, a huge national bank or Federal Reserve or a very large retail bank gets hacked. What does that have to actually do to me, you know, do with me? Do you think that the general public is still largely unaware of the effects of cybercrime? And possibly, why do you think that is?
No, I think far less so than before. I think most people I speak to have had either themselves or a friend or relative fall victim to some kind of scam. And inevitably, that is more often than not computer related. So while some of these you might say, well, that's not technically really a hacking incident, people having money taken from them being defrauded and scammed through digital means is definitely a thing. So I think the public are onto it. I want to know more. I think that the fact that a cybercrime documentary about North Korea got to number one in the UK podcast charts and number seven in the US, you know, means that there are literally millions of people who want to know about this stuff. So again, that idea of, oh, nobody's really interested, not true, absolutely not true. I think you're right. I think linking it to people's real daily lives, it is difficult. And that's something I've always been confronted with as a journalist, is, oh, what difference does it make to me? You know, what's the difference make to this person? Frankly, if all you care about is what difference things make to you directly, what's right in front of your nose, most of the news wouldn't exist.
And speaking of sort of how it affects people's lives, obviously a lot of businesses fall victim to cybercrime, as we know a lot about. But in the book, you write that businesses seem achingly unready, which I thought was a lovely way of putting it, to deal with cybercrime. In your estimation, do you think businesses have got better or worse at cyber resilience? Do you think it's still enough of a priority?
I think businesses have got better. I really do think that. I think it is a very rare business now that doesn't see that there's some kind of cybercrime threat and know that that's a threat. And I think what businesses are still catching up with is what to do about it. I will say I don't know the extent to which the tech security industry has been massively helpful about that, because often its response is, spend all your money now on my big flashy box. And by the way, keep spending every year because this is a 5-year contract or whatever. Look, that's how some companies make money. Fair enough, I get that. But I think you do have to sort of meet businesses halfway. And I think what businesses are crying out for is insight and knowledge and wisdom about which bits to protect and how. But also going back to your loyal resilience piece, you know, if we are telling people it's a matter of when, not if you get hacked, resilience has to be part of it. And so there is this second question of, okay, assume they're in, assume they're going to get in, assume they navigate around. How are you going to deal with that? Those sort of, you know, wargaming exercises are quite useful. I think risk-based helps is the way to go, because, you know, if you look at boards and how boards think and work, you know, what they assess is risks to businesses. So I think if you're talking that language, even just using that word, you're immediately a little bit more aligned with what the people who run the business actually think about and talk about.
Speaking of risk, one thing I wanted to ask you reading the book was, I was sort of sitting there going, but how well protected is Jeff?
Oh, God, yes. Do you have it?
I mean, are you concerned of any repercussions from some of the groups that you are investigating? And, you know, are you now, do you practice what you preach, and are you unbelievably cyber resilient?
It's a very good question. Look, not as cyber resilient as I could be, but then nobody's ever 100% secure, are they? We do take this really seriously. Working with the BBC, they took it very, very seriously. You know, we have a shields up approach. Gene Lee, my co-presenter for the podcast, obviously very experienced journalist working in North Korea, is well used to this kind of stuff. In terms of what I do, the stuff I do actually is I'm a one person business basically, but I try and do what I talk about in talks to businesses and what I see, I hear advisors and wise people telling businesses to do. So I have an offsite backup. I obviously take incoming email, incoming links and attachments very, very seriously. I have some other technical bits and bobs that I do. But that's really, you know, and so for businesses, I think the stuff that businesses do, I do on a much, much smaller scale for myself.
And you spoke to lots of people for the book and for the podcast as well. Some of the interviews for the podcast were really, really fascinating to listen to. Which bit of your research, I suppose, did you find the most interesting or surprising? Because there's so many interesting stories that that you managed to weave in. Was there one in particular that you had to share that surprised you the most?
It was the stuff around this character, Hush Puppy, remarkably an Instagram influencer with 2.3 million followers, who by day is posing, frankly, in Gucci and Versace and, you know, toting his Yves Saint Laurent handbag around Dubai, but by night is involved in all sorts of dodgy cybercrime activity and has now been found guilty in the US. And that story of just him leading this incredible double life, where on the surface he's the classic Instagram influencer. He's got all these brands on. The idea that he went home, closed the door, switched on his laptop and defrauded people for millions of dollars and could sustain that level of double life, I just think is it's endlessly remarkable.
What fascinates you the most about investigating cybercrime?
It's an entire underworld industry. You know, this economy is a well-developed industry with different players, and realizing they have an HR department, they do interviews, they have somebody who takes care of payroll, they have a marketing person. This is a business, like a startup.
And I think the entire thing is super fascinating, and I really can't wait for the release of your book, because I'm going to definitely be getting a copy of that and devouring it. So, Jeff, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. We always like to end our episodes by asking our guests three simple questions.
You've written two books now. What do you wish you'd known before you started writing either of them?
That's a very good question. I wish I'd have known quite how organized you have to be. If I had to give advice to anybody writing a book, and you know, if you want to contact me on social media, have a chat about it, very happy to do that. But you have to be organized, so disciplined. You have to keep a track of everything, particularly websites. You have to print everything out and do screen grabs, because it won't be there when you go back in a year's time to do your sourcing. So organize was the thing I wish I'd been able to tell myself.
Okay. And what are you reading or listening to at the moment? I mean, apart from your book and the podcast series, is there anything that you'd recommend for our listeners? And before you answer that, if you can add in there somewhere, will there be season two of the Lazarus Heist podcast?
Look, to answer that last question first, yes, there is a season two. We are working on it at the moment. It is bonkers. Some of the stories are just bonkers. Some of the interviewees we're getting. We're finding interviewees that I just never believed we'd ever manage to find. You know, you set out your arm, let's go try and get that person. We'll probably never get them. And then we've got them. Just incredible stories. So I'm really super excited about season two. That's going to be out later this year, you know, October-ish. Don't hold me to that. Stuff that I'm reading at the moment, I'm reading Oliver Bulloh's book, Butler to the World, which is how the UK, Britain, became, as the title suggests, Butler to the World, how we launder and wash the world's money, how we launder and wash the world's reputations, how Britain has basically become a sort of, you know, posh servant economy. It's an interesting book, it's a really interesting book. And his other book is called Moneyland, which is very good as well.
And looking to the future, as we like to do, this time next year, where do you think we'll be in the world of nation-sponsored cyber attacks? Are you investigating anything in particular?
The iteration of ransomware, what's going to happen next with ransomware? Because, I mean, their coffers are so full, those guys. You just wonder, there's got to be a next iteration. So also keep tuned for that.
And Jeff, finally, where can our listeners get hold of your new book when it finally launches? And in fact, I believe you're on the speaking circuit as well. And where can they get in touch with you for those sorts of things?
Oh, yeah, yeah. If you follow me on Twitter, it's JeffWhite247, Jeff with a G, white like the color, and then the numbers 247. I tweet stuff there about where I'm going to appear and so on. And I was going to list at the various conferences. And the book is available, obviously, on the big ones, on Amazon, on Waterstones, but also bookshop.org. And if you order through bookshop.org, it comes from your local bookstore. So you're sort of supporting your local bookstore without even necessarily having to find out where it is. So you can go there as well.
And when's it out?
June the 9th is the
June the 9th. Yeah. Everybody go and get the book. You will learn so much.
Thank you.
I loved it. And thank you all so much. Well, thank you, Jeff, first of all. Thank you so much for your time and for sharing your wisdom today.
Thanks
and thank
me.
You all so much to all our listeners for joining us on this week's Fishy Business. It has been a pleasure to have you with us. And if you've enjoyed our podcast, please leave us a review on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you're hearing this. And feel free to follow us on Twitter @Mimecast if you'd like to learn more about what we discussed today. Till next time.